It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus. The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, March 7th, the Join My Consciousness Raising Circle edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of XX. I'm here in the D.C. studio today with Dan Coyce, who's a senior editor at Slate. Hi, Dan.
Hey.
And also Noreen Malone of The New Republic joins us in New York. Hi, Noreen.
Hello.
Our topics for today are, first, how the women of Silicon Valley are trying to remake feminism. Second, Time Magazine's startling photo essay on domestic violence. And third, sleeping with your sources. The new Netflix series House of Cards suggests that this is a job hazard for women journalists. So we will discuss whether this is true or not. So let's start with Sheryl Sandberg. Her new book, Lean In, doesn't even come out until next week, but it's already starting new angry debates, this time among working women instead of mothers. In this book, Sandberg gives advice to women on how to change their behavior at work to be more ambitious, to negotiate better, to act confident, to seek out new opportunities. Along with the book, Sandberg is rolling out a plan to launch a movement of lean-in circles intended to be consciousness-raising groups where women tell stories and trade tips on how to succeed. Sandberg has been accused of putting too much blame on women and being out of touch because she's so rich and successful herself. I don't think I really want to talk about the book here yet because it's not out, although we'll mention it a little bit, but why don't I start with you, Noreen? Would you like to join my consciousness circle?
No.
Why not? Come on.
I guess I'm a little unclear on what exactly consciousness circles are and how they are different from, say, friendships with people. Like, I would love to get a drink with you after work sometime, Hannah, and, like, shoot the shit about work. But I'm not sure I want to sit there and read social stats, you know, social scientists' latest studies on, like, what breastfeeding means for people in the workplace. Like, that just doesn't seem that helpful to me. And maybe I'm getting consciousness circles wrong, but...
No, actually, Slate is about to run a story on consciousness circles, which I edited, so we'll put that on the Facebook page. But consciousness circles, the difference is that if we were going out to coffee, you would be able to bitch to me about crappy things that are happening at work. But according to Sheryl Sandberg, if we were in a lean-in circle together, it would be incumbent upon you to have solutions to your crappy situations.
Yeah,
so that's
well,
the big difference.
Okay, I'm not in then. I'm definitely definitely out.
Wait, why are you not in? I mean, so why are you against the notion of getting together with a bunch of friends and working out, like telling positive stories of things that have worked for you?
I mean, first of all, I was joking a little bit, but I do think that those sort of impromptu sessions with friends usually do end with one person giving the other person advice, right? That's just the natural progression of what happens in a conversation when you raise a problem. The other person tries to solve it. I think there's something... So in Sandberg's book, and this has been in a lot of the reviews, so I'm not spoiling anything, she talks about how she hates it when young women come up to her and ask, like, will you be my mentor, essentially? And to me, a consciousness circle is sort of the same thing, right? It's saying, will you be my friend? And, like, let's formalize it. And will you be my support network? And I'm not trying to belittle the importance of a support network, particularly when it comes to work. But I think there is something a little off about doing it in such an inorganic way.
Wait, now, Dan, is this a male-female difference, this idea that women just want to have a space to bitch and men want to solve the problem? I mean, that's what one says in marriages, right?
Yeah, I've always thought that that is sort of the dynamic. That certainly is the dynamic in our marriage. Like, when my wife wants to just be able to complain about things, and then I'm always like, well, why don't you try this? And she's like, shut up.
Right,
I'm not interested in that. But at the same time, like, I think that for a lot of women, the ability to formalize these relationships would be great, considering that many of them have trouble making these relationships in the first place. Like, I just feel like if you are a woman who writes about feminist issues and writes about feminism in the workplace and feminism at home, it is not hard to find sympathetic ears or colleagues to talk about these issues with. But most women facing the issues that Sheryl Sandberg is talking about do not necessarily have an email inbox full of confidants who they can send these questions to or share these stories with. And I feel like my wife, for example, would be delighted to like have a monthly meeting with working women where they can specifically sit down and talk about these stories. On the other hand, I would never let her go because she has to help me take care of the kids.
Fair point.
This might be a personality difference. I mean, in what I know about you, Dan, you're a person who, you know, there's some people who can naturally create a lot of communities around. I'm speaking about karaoke here, obviously,
right.
But
yeah, obviously.
You know, like, but still, it's a form of like, you know, semi-formalized community building, which maybe Noreen is just temperamentally not that into, even though Noreen's like a really lovely person and very personable and friendly. Maybe just the idea of formalizing it is alien to some people and not alien to other people.
Well, I mean, it certainly is like, I mean, it certainly is square, right? It is super square to want to sit down with a bunch of other working women and share your success stories. But the very idea of these lean-in circles and consciousness-raising sessions is totally square. But I don't know that that means that it wouldn't be helpful to a huge number of women.
I think I fall somewhere in between you guys, which is that I would want to go and then I would never go. Like, I would theoretically be really into it, but I just wouldn't actually make it.
Because you're too busy juggling.
No, just because at the last minute my hard irony would kick in and I just couldn't bring myself to do it, even though I have like, you know, I've sort of, my balance doesn't work in a smooth way. It's like one minute I'm like this and the next minute I'm like that. So,
you know, I've done versions of this. I'm realizing it's all like flashing before me as I'm sitting here thinking of it. At two out of the three places where I've worked, there were people who made an effort to be like, let's all the ladies who work here get drinks, right? And that is it's an informal way of doing the same thing, which is network. Well, I guess maybe networking is something we need to separate out here. But that's for me, I was totally on board with that. But there's something about when you bring it into the Sheryl Sandberg, like, it's this corporate lingo, right? She's applying this corporate lingo to what she's calling a feminist movement. And there's something in me that is just, not quite on board with the branding.
Yeah, it's like Revolution by PowerPoint. It has corporate sponsors. I mean, it's extremely strange and feels not quite as fully realized as the book. Like, the book, I think, is fully realized, is backed by a lot of research, has very excellent advice in it, and I would urge you all to go out and read it if you're interested in thinking more about your careers. But the consciousness circles are kind of thinly realized. Now, let's move on a little bit to talk about the reaction to the book, which hasn't even come out yet. There's been a huge amount of reaction already. The first wave of it was negative.
It was not even a reaction to the book. It was a reaction to the persona of Sheryl Sandberg.
Right.
And what they believe the book to be.
What they believe the book to be. And this idea of leaning in and this idea of her as a spokeswoman for leaning in. And let me just explain. Leaning in means, you know, connecting with your ambition. You know, her famous phrase, don't leave before you leave. This idea that women disconnect from their ambition sometime in their 20s and 30s and they stop sort of being go-getters because they figure one day they're going to have kids or because they lack a certain amount of confidence or they're not straightforward in their work or there are all sorts of things about the way women are socialized and behave in the workplace which makes them tune out a little too early. So that's basically what her idea of lean in means. And this rubbed a lot of people the wrong way because they felt like, well, number one, easy for you to say, Sheryl, because you're rich and fancy and already successful. And number two, you know, I can't believe she's saying this when there's so many external barriers to women succeeding. I disagree with both of those criticisms, but Noreen, do you have any reaction to the reaction?
I'm with you. I don't think there's a ton of merit to them. She's pretty clear about who she's talking to, and I think she sort of operates under the like trickle down version of feminism that if you fix things at the top, you'll get people in place to fix the rest of it. But there is something about the tone of the criticism that was weird. And, you know, Maureen Dowd did sort of a Maureen Dowd number where she made reference to her expensive shoes and she, you know, talked about how she was like a pom-pom girl for feminism, which is sort of just dripping with condescension. So I didn't love any of that criticism. And so I wasn't quite, even though I'm not fully sold on the radicalness of Sheryl Sandberg's vision, which is what the Sheryl Sandberg supporters seem to be framing it as. But but I couldn't get behind the Sheryl Sandberg naysayers either.
Right. I feel like it's one thing to make fun of like Marissa Mayer for banning remote working when she has her nursery adjoining her office, but it's another thing to discount Sheryl Sandberg's opinion just because she's rich and successful,
right,
when theoretically she is rich and successful because she followed this exact,
yes,
plan.
Exactly. That's what's really weird about it. I mean, that's the nature of the American guru, right? Like, you start out, she didn't start out rich and successful. She was like a nerdy girl. I mean, she writes about it. She's like a nerdy girl from a suburb, I think in Florida. And then she, you know, presumably followed her own advice. And then she became a rich person with a 9,000 square foot house and a lot of power. So presumably you can too, if you follow her advice.
Well, and this is what I'm hung up on. And what you've written about, Hannah, is that this is kind of a self-help book, right? Like, this is not, I didn't, maybe it's just because I've been marinating in all this stuff for years because of my job. And this is like something that I write and think a little bit about. But to me, it just really seems like a self-help manual and not anything that's breaking new intellectual ground, even though it's being treated in the press as such. And what you wrote, Hannah, you can surely explain it a lot better. But you certainly sort of said that this is where we are in feminism. Individuals need advice. It's no longer necessarily about collective action, at least in this bit of feminism. Is that,
yeah,
fair?
And I think her mentor chapter shows that the best, right? Like, the impulses of the consciousness raising and of the advice in the book are kind of at odds with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the in the book, the advice is, you know, every woman for herself, sort of workshop the problems in your own workplace, look out for your own career. And then you've got this collectivist sisterhood consciousness raising thing that's going on in the lean-in circles. But I do think the book is excellent and has lots of excellent advice.
But yeah. So is that what you sort of respond negatively to, like this notion that that you feel like these consciousness raising circles are really just a way of Sheryl Sandberg building her brand and
No, I think they might work for some people. I don't know. I don't have any opinion about them. I don't care about them. I don't think they're important. I think they're sort of, you know, something to make fun of for people like us because they seem so corny. But I don't, if they work, great. Like, if some groups of women get together and share their tips, like, what, how does that bother me? No, actually, what I'm focused on is this weird way in which the kinds of women who say there should be more female CEOs, every time they're presented with an actual female CEO or executive, they find her distasteful.
Right.
Right? That's a weird irony. Like,
right,
we look at rich women and we think, ew. Or not we, but, you know, a certain kind of feminist who complains about the lack of CEOs. CEOs are never going to look like what feminists want them to look like. Female executive is not going to be nurturing and nice and wonderful and friendly and sort of create a sisterhood in her environment. She's going to be distasteful to you. So that's, I think, something that we need to resolve.
And I would like to add that actually I read the book pretty quickly, but I, as skeptical as I'm sounding now, I was sort of cheering along and like underlining passages that I think will help me. Like, it really is in the same way that anytime I read a self-help book, like, you underline things that really, you're like, yeah, that's me. That's going to change everything. So I would second Tana in saying that it is a useful read if you are someone who is interested in getting ahead at work.
So I'm going to put you on the spot before we move on.
Sure.
Can you remember any particular advice? Because Sandberg and I looked at the same research. I have some of it in my book. And I actually have tried to follow specific bits of advice about how women should negotiate and sort of what they do wrong and what they can get away with and what they can't, a lot of which Sandberg has in her book as well.
Yeah. You know, the stuff that resonated with me was sort of just the way you carry yourself, right? That if you sort of slump into things and just don't act like you're in charge. No one's going to treat you like you're in charge. It's pretty obvious stuff, but it bears repeating. You know, if you are in a meeting, you need to talk up. All that kind of stuff. You do see play out a lot in any kind of workplace.
I'm laughing because Dan was puffing himself up. He doesn't quite realize, because he's been talking to us for a long time, that he's a man. So this advice doesn't actually apply to him. So
I'm sitting in a power position.
Exactly.
Which should allow me to take charge of this conversation for our second topic.
And I also, you know, shove this down my daughter's throat. Like, I make her negotiate for, like, somebody asked her to house sit and I made her negotiate the price of the house sitting, much to her total horror. Like, she can't stand it, but I actually do shove it down her throat. So I believe in this.
Yeah, the negotiation stuff is helpful.
It's great. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is this painful domestic violence photo essay. But before we do that, I want to welcome back our loyal sponsor, Audible.com. Audible offers over 100,000 audiobooks, as well as almost any form of enlightened chatter available on the internet. And you can listen to them on practically any device, including the one you're using to listen to us right now. For XX listeners who are not already Audible members, they're offering a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX. That's XX, not XX. And my recommendation for this week is obvious. It's Lean In, which is available in just about a week. It's not read by Sheryl Sandberg, but nonetheless, you can do like, was it Magnolia? What movie was it where someone listens to self-help tapes on her way to selling houses?
I don't know.
It's sort of like, it's one of those things you can listen to on the drive to work. And
well, Laura Walters does listen to a lot of self-help tapes in Magnolia, but I can't remember if she's on her way to selling houses.
Anyway, there you go. You can listen to it in the car and you can feel pumped up when you go to your next work meeting. Okay, the Time Magazine essay. Time Magazine ran a very painful photo essay documenting a specific incident of domestic abuse in real time. The photographer, who I am having trouble pronouncing her name, we decided it's Sarah Lefkovich?
I think Sarah Naomi Lefkovich, yeah.
Lefkovich,
that's my best
guess. Was following a man as he got out of prison, and she got to know his girlfriend and her two children. She's a photojournalist. And one night, as they were coming back from a bar, they began to argue and fight, and Sarah captured the whole incident on in photographs, including him choking her and their toddler daughter freaking out. And the photo essay is beautiful, horrifying, and enlightens us both about domestic violence and the complicated ethics of being a photojournalist. So before we get to the ethics part, let's talk about the photo essay itself and what it looks like. So Dan, can you describe what are the images that stuck with you the most, or sort of what did it get you thinking about when you saw these various images?
I mean, she's a really remarkable photographer. And I mean, I know that part of the way photojournalism works is that you take an unbelievable amount of frames and what we see are the best ones. But these images of these people's lives, I mean, their names are Shane and Maggie. Shane, who just got out of prison, and Maggie, his girlfriend, who's much younger than him. And so these photos tell a story, and the story isn't just the actual incident, but it also tells the lead up to that incident with him finding her and them falling in love after he gets out of prison, and his struggles and bonding with her son, and the easy way that he bonds with her daughter. And these are presented in a very intimate way. I mean, right down to seeing him and the daughter snuggle and him and the son having a haircut together and clearly having trouble bonding. But the image that stuck with me that seemed most symbolic of this entire relationship between them was this image of three of them on the couch watching TV, and she, the girlfriend, Maggie, is in the middle, and her son is on one side and he's got his legs wrapped around her, and Shane, her boyfriend, is on the other side and he has his legs wrapped around her. And this accompanies this part of the essay where Sarah is talking about the way that he feels competitive with her son, who's very, very little, who's a very little boy, and the way that he feels like he never comes first in that relationship, and that the son always comes first, and that he feels like he's constantly in competition with Maggie for her affection. And that, to me, seems to be sort of the instigating dilemma that he faces, and the thing that is sort of at the root of what eventually causes this big blow up between them that culminates in him choking her.
That jealousy of the son just killed me. I mean, I know that's a phenomenon. I recall a New York Post editorial from many years ago, which was called something like Ban the Stepfather, in which they, you know, they looked over violence statistics and realized that a large number of household violence and chaos is caused by the man who enters the scene, whether it's the boyfriend or the stepfather. And the idea that, I know this is completely common, but and I guess visceral and sort of relatable at some level, but the idea that he feels jealousy of this little kid. I mean, of course, you immediately think of Susan Smith, who drowned her two children. Like, this is a very real phenomenon of the man feeling jealousy of the wife's attention to the children. And you sort of feel bad for her in the ways that she's torn as a mother and a girlfriend, and just for the kids. Besides what Dan mentioned, the other thing that killed me was the little girl's reaction, because she was sort of preternaturally emotionally absorbed. That's a really weird phrase, but what I mean by that is she was very in tune with all the conflicting emotions in the household and was always trying to protect her mother or, you know, save them from something. Like, she kind of knew too much. She was a little girl who clearly knew and had seen too much and had absorbed it all.
And the mother herself was so young. That's another thing that I just in every photograph, her face was just so, so young. And you know, that's something that comes across, you know, when you see the age 19 in the essay accompanying the photographs, you see that number on the page, but it's not the same thing as the pictures over and over again.
Well, it's easy to see why she has been swept away by him in some respect. You know, he is older. He's 31. He gets his name tattooed on. He gets her name tattooed on his neck in this big, like horror movie font, mm-hmm. almost immediately in huge letters. And
I think they'd been dating for a month, right? When they,
when the photographer found them at the county fair. And then you see through the storytelling of this photo essay, all the sort of traditional hallmarks of the way that abusive relationships develop. He isolates her from her family and friends by moving them out to a trailer someplace where he can get work. They end up staying with his friends in another town. He is jealous and possessive. They go out for what's supposed to be a special night on the town, and it devolves into this big argument, which then leads to the climactic event in this photo essay, which Sarah Lefkowitz captured in her photographs.
So let's come to the heartbreaking photograph where he is literally choking her. You're watching as you click through the photo essay, the heat in this particular argument. You know, the photo essay has two paces. One pace is very slow. It's the arc of a developing relationship. It's like they meet, they move in together, they hang around, they get a haircut. And then all of a sudden, the photo essay speeds up and you're in one night. And it's like they argue, he chokes her, the daughter runs into the room, she's puking over the toilet. You know, it just kind of speeds up suddenly. And it's really hard to watch. Did you guys? So the photojournalist was then criticized for not putting her camera away and calling the police. Did you guys have that thought that one person wrote about the photojournalist? Why didn't she put down her camera and clock Shane over the head with it?
I think it's hard to not have that thought instantaneously, at least, right? But when you think about it, and the photojournalist wrote a post in response to some of these anonymous commenters on the internet, in which she detailed why, you know, what she did. She got her phone back from the guy who had borrowed it, and she called 911. And there was another adult there who was protecting the child. The photojournalist was a very small woman herself. This guy was in an angry rage. I mean, it makes sense. And also, I don't think she should have not published this, you know, this essay just because it, you know, there could have been this one moment where maybe she could have stepped in, according to some people. I think it was a really, really powerful look. And if she had put down her camera in that moment, she would have lost that. And whether that was worth it, that's the really tough debate, right?
I want to read a couple of sentences. I thought her response to this criticism was one of the best responses to journalistic criticism I've ever read because it was straightforward. It was welcoming of more conversation. It was not defensive at all, and it just stated the facts. I made sure the police were called. I stayed with them and didn't let Shane get Maggie alone with him. I surrendered my photos after being subpoenaed. I rubbed Maggie's back while she was throwing up after the attack. I drove her to her best friend's house after the assault, slept on the couch in the same room as her, and held her as she was crying. I'm sorry you feel this wasn't enough, but frankly, you sound self-righteous. I have no regrets about how I handled that situation.
We should note this was a comment that she posted on the original site that posted these photos, which is a photo collection site called photovisura.com, which then Time picked it up from about a month later. But that, and she has, you know, written and talked about it afterwards as well since it got published on Time and came to much greater attention. But those were her initial response to the first person who posted on this initial site questioning what she did at that time. And I think she's right. I mean, we were not there, and we do not know the situation, but it is hard to envision a situation in which things would have been made better by her putting down her camera and trying to hit Shane on the head with it. Like, it's just hard to imagine that would have had a positive result for anyone.
But putting that camera clocking over the head, because that's a slightly extreme phenomenon, what about just more intervention? Like, or what about just the sort of crass, that sort of weird feeling you must have at the moment you're taking a photograph that this is a great photograph, that you're documenting a great moment?
That's unbelievably difficult. And that one reason I could never be a photojournalist is that I wouldn't be able to disassociate myself in a moment like that. I would be barfing myself and unable to handle it. But we count on good photojournalists in moments of crisis everywhere to be able to document what the world is like. And so, I mean, I view this functionally as no different than a really good photojournalist being in a war zone and getting an important shot of a tactical maneuver or a resistance fighter in the middle of battle or something like that. I mean, this was a war zone that she was in, and she documented it because that is her job.
I had that same thought, but probably even a colder version of that thought, which is, you know, there's so little of that that happens now. Like, it happens in war. It takes a huge amount of time to see things unfold in real time. Like, I was listening to This American Life just did their show about the Chicago school that they were in, where there's been a huge, tremendous number of shootings and violence. And one thing I realized when I listened to the show is that they don't capture that much in real time. Even though they were there for a few months, they mostly capture people talking about what happened.
Right.
And I think because, you know, the time allotted for such projects has shrunk and shrunk, this kind of thing is a luxury, and we don't really get that much of it. And so I appreciate it when it comes, even if it comes in this form.
It's worth noting that it came about because she's a grad student.
Right.
This was not a project that Time sent her on or anything. This was her grad school project, and that is what it took for a photographer to be able to sit with these people who normally would not be the subject of a glamorous photo essay in Time, and become trusted enough by them that when this thing happened, she was able to stay and take these photos.
Noreen, do you have any ethical quandaries, or are you basically on our team?
No, I'm absolutely on your team. It feels awful to say it, but if we, you know, back to consciousness raising, you know, if you're going to have consciousness of domestic violence, there's really not a better way to do it than with searing images like these.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, we're all in agreement. So let's move on to our third topic. The Netflix series House of Cards portrays one young female journalist who sleeps with her major source a lot, and another older one who claims that she, I can't remember the quote, but it's like a suck, fuck, everything that moves kind of quote. Yeah. That she slept with a lot of them. This week in the New Republic, another young woman journalist who works in Washington gave us a picture of what it's really like to have congressmen and other high-powered Washington types hit on you. It was far less glamorous than what's portrayed in House of Cards, but nonetheless, it's pretty disturbing and uncomfortable. Noreen, when you read Marin Kogan's piece, were you horrified? Did it feel familiar? Like, what in it spoke to you, since you being a young journalist who has here now and again worked in Washington?
Right. I mean, it's not a world that I'm in. I've never been a beat reporter of that kind. I've never worked on the Hill. But I wasn't really shocked. I guess the degree of some of it, Marin describes, you know, one environmental reporter went for drinks with a source, and he like kind of like grazed her thigh, and then he goes, "You should shave your legs," you know, like in this really this really awful, sketchy old man way. But also,
was that the one at L'Oreal Plaza?
I think so. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It was. Yeah, and you know, there Marin had to end a relationship with her, with I guess her best source on the Hill, because he said something inappropriate. I mean, it makes sense. It's like, it's older men who have lost all, you know, they have a weird sense of their own power, and sometimes that extends to their own conceptions of their sexual power. And, you know, as she writes in the piece, there is something about cultivating a source relationship that is a whole lot like the rituals of dating or flirting, right? Like, you're asking someone for coffee, you're being really nice to them, and, you know,
you're listening.
Right. You're listening. You're listening. Yeah. That's all it is. But people, and you know, people do on occasion flirt.
And you also want it to go deeper, right? Like you're looking, you're going through the stages where you want it to become more intimate and confessional and revelatory.
Well, but you're trusting that you're on that track, right? But you're trusting that the switchman will hit the switch to get you on the source track and not the date track at exactly the right time.
Right. Now, Hannah, you have actually been the young girl DC reporter about town. What did you think of this piece?
You know, I'm sorry to say that no one ever rubbed against my leg. Maybe that's because I shaved my legs, you know, or maybe because I was just completely obtuse and didn't realize it. I mean, it struck me that also it has to do with Washington and its little bit of uncoolness, right? That people reading signals incorrectly, like maybe the story would unfold completely differently if it had happened in L.A. I mean, one thing I loved about the New Republic piece is that House of Cards, of course, glamorizes Washington. You mm-hmm. know, it makes these relationships seem kind of edgy and sexy and exciting. In that series, the young woman who's sleeping with House Whip kind of knows what she's doing, and it's all happening at the same time. It's not that they're walking on eggshells or trying to avoid each other or can't figure out which kind of relationship they have. She actively invites both kinds of relationships, right? She wants to have sex with him, and she wants him to be her major source. So,
right. It's presented in some way as at least weirdly empowering, and that she is using him at least as much as he is using her, I presume.
Yes, and they understand each other perfectly.
Right.
Like she, in fact, by thus behaving, he knows that she's his type, you know, that she can play the game as well as he can play the game. He wouldn't have done it with someone who, you know, slept with him and then was like, oh, my God, what are we doing? Are we sources or are we lovers? Like that wouldn't have been his kind of person. So she's playing pretty hard.
Like, so I would love to read the rebuttal piece to this New Republic piece from someone who, if there is a person like that in Washington, are there female reporters like that who just at some point in the past said, well, fuck this, I'm going to play the game. And I don't care. I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm going to get my stories. Like, I would love to know if that has happened.
I don't know if you could get a version of that story. I mean, I'm sure that's happened on very, very, very rare occasions. What I'm sure you could get a version of is someone explaining how exactly she flirts to get a story and what is the line you don't cross, right? Because I would be willing to bet that both of you guys have, in a minor way, probably flirted with sources.
I guess, although I think it's just, it reads totally different coming from a dude.
Right. I'm trying to remember when I was younger, I think I flirted with the younger sources, right? There's a lot of younger people on the Hill, but that wasn't totally inauthentic, you know?
Right, right. Yeah.
Like I was a young person in a world in which some of us were journalists, others of us were Hill staffers or whatever, chiefs of staff to congressmen. We were kind of all in it together, you know? So it wasn't that gross. It wasn't like the really old dude, you know? And in House of Cards, by the way, it's clear that she has a thing for really old dudes in general, that it's not her first really old dude.
Yeah, that's true.
And it is interesting to me that there is a real dichotomy, right? Like, I mean, there is the forever trope of the skeezball journalist guy who writes a profile of a woman, and that profile just ends up being all about how he's positive she totally wanted to sleep with him.
Well, right? And there has been a rash lately of magazine stories where it was either strongly implied or directly cited that the male subject tried to sleep with the female writer. Like most recently, there was a Drake profile, I think, in GQ, right? Where the next to last line is something like Drake like pointing to the bedroom and being like, so are we going to do this?
But I always assume that's the subject, you know, trying to ensure a good profile. Like I once had to interview Richard Gere for some reason that I don't remember. It had to do with Buddhism or something. And he was so overpoweringly flirtatious that it struck me that all he was doing here was kind of putting me off guard, right? Like that's his particular power. Like I have the pen, I get to write what I want in the end, but his power is to sort of flatter and charm me into thinking that he is particularly like enchanted by me. You know,
did you write something nice?
No. I'm hard in my soul.
Good.
I don't fall for that. So the bigger universal question is, which has been around for a long time, is the female mentorship by male mentors. My friend Margaret Talbot wrote an amazing story about this in Lingua Franca about, you know, a case in which a professor was accused of sort of sleeping with or doing something with female students. And you know, is there any way that's been invented for that kind of source relationship or mentor relationship to happen and completely avoid sexual tension?
Sure, if the guy is not a complete gigantic asshole.
Or
really? You think it's that simple? You think it's
it couldn't hurt.
I don't know. I mean, this is like something they discuss in corporate circles all the time, how inappropriate it is for the male mentor to, you know, drive alone with the woman or have dinner. Like, there are just avenues of access that two men have with each other that a woman and a man don't have. Like, if they went out to dinner with each other, would that be weird? All that kind of stuff.
Well, and I mean, and the fact that we're talking about it in this way, like, let's bring in Sheryl Sandberg. Like, we shouldn't be still talking. The more we talk about this stuff, the more we're perpetuating it, right? Like, the less weird we make it for, like, a 25-year-old woman to have a 50-year-old mentor, like the easier we're going to make it on both of them, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I certainly am worried about when I am 50, and just in general, working with people younger than me terrifies me because I'll be so old. But like, more specifically, I do worry about this all the time. Like, if there is like a really bright young woman in the office who I think is worth like taking under my wing, like, how do I do that in a way that's not gross? How do I even like suggest to her that I want to do that without her being like, oh, guess what Dan said to me today? Oh, God.
He said I was talented.
Right.
No, there is totally a non-gross way to do it. You just, like, help the person, like, give the person assignments. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a 50-year-old man. I can't really speak to their world. But I think that there has to be a non-gross way of doing it. And you know, I think that women tend to be more on edge about this stuff than men in general. Maybe I'm wrong here, Dan. But I don't think that you have to think about, you know, going to coffee with sources in the same way, right? Like that's not something that you're ever worried about the propriety of it, right?
You're saying you as a woman always have to worry that you're sending out the wrong signal.
Right. Whereas I basically never worry about it.
I don't know.
It's never even dawned on me at all.
No, you know, Noreen, when you were saying we have to stop worrying about this stuff, the same goes for you. You know, you ask someone for coffee, you have coffee with them, you behave in a professional manner, like, done, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I worry. I'm just trying to, like, extend the conversation a little bit more broadly. I don't think, I don't know, it seems like there is still a real hang-up around it, and I don't particularly feel any of that, but maybe I'm just out of step with the culture.
I think I would land on what's wrong with a little flirtation. Like, why are we so scared of it? What's the big deal?
Yeah, that's true.
I have a question along those lines. I'm sorry, Noreen, go ahead.
No, go ahead with your question.
So in the piece, you mentioned that she says she basically had to cut ties with her best source because he, like, came on to her.
Mm-hmm.
But so why? Why do you have to cut ties with him for that reason?
Well,
I understand it's uncomfortable, but I have all kinds of uncomfortable relationships with people who I am eventually interviewing for some reason.
Well, and also I was thinking about this in the context of House of Cards. So I was like, well, now she has, like, power over him. Like,
right.
Why wouldn't she use that? Like, which is probably not the way real people think. But you know, back to the question of mentorship, one thing that has been sort of battered around a lot on the internet in our corner of the world are these stats on from Vita on whether magazines like the New Republic and Harper's and the Atlantic and the New Yorker are publishing enough women and enough and are publishing enough book reviews of books by women. And, you know, they're not, like, the numbers are crazy skewed towards men. And, you know, one of the reasons I think is that editors who are men tend to be afraid to mentor women, younger women writers. And then that's what you see in these pie charts of the byline disparity.
You know what, Noreen? It's time for our lean-in circle.
I know.
We got to take on this problem.
I know. There you go. I know. I mean, it is a real thing. Like, there are all kinds of reasons for it. But, you know, like tends to hire like.
Right.
Yeah, but even when like is doing his damnedest to hire not like, as you have found out, Noreen, and looking through resumes, men are just extremely aggressive pitchers in general. Because they've been socialized to be, I guess, but that means I have spent the last year at the Slate Book Review since we launched it, trying every month as hard as I can to assign more pieces by women than men.
Is that true? Do you actively think about
that? Yes, I actively try.
Why?
And I actively fail.
Why?
I
hate that you have to
wait.
Think
what
about
do you
it?
Mean you fail?
I failed. I assigned. We had more freelance reviews written by men than by women this year.
Why did you fail? You feel because you didn't try hard enough, or not enough women took the jobs, or like you couldn't think of enough women to write the reviews, or why did you fail?
I definitely could have tried harder. I mean, I guess I tried really hard though. I got way more pitches. I would say for every one pitch I get from a woman to write about something, I get four pitches from a guy. When I say no to guys, they always pitch again instantly. When I say no to women, they almost never pitch again.
Okay.
Even when I encourage them, even when I say, please pitch me again.
This,
yeah, go on.
Well, this is my grand theory of work and dating, right? Like, I think that that we tend, for whatever reasons, maybe just lessons brought down through the eons by natural selection and Darwinism, we tend to approach our work lives and our love lives in somewhat similar ways, right? So men are socialized to be the aggressors, and women are socialized to play by the rules when it comes to dating, right? Even if that's less the case now than it used to be, most women prefer to be asked out than to do the asking out. And so, you know, if that's the way you're approaching one thing, then it sort of makes sense that you're not going to want to pitch. You're going to want to have an editor reach out to you. You're not going to want to, like, apply for that big new job. You're going to want to have them headhunt you. Does that make sense
to
you
guys? Okay, but this is why Sheryl Sandberg's book is, if not revolutionary, incredibly useful, because she just calls bullshit on a lot of that, right? At least you didn't say women are biologically programmed, right? They are right. socialized to behave this way.
Right.
But it turns out that that way is not that useful at work. You don't have to be exactly like a man, but, you know, I've witnessed it myself. Like, the way men behave, say, post-rejection, post-workplace rejection, is remarkable. They're just not that emotional about it. They're like, okay, well, we'll find another piece, or I'll find another job for myself. And women don't really do that. They, like, nurture the hurt. It's not to say that women shouldn't be women. It's just that maybe you should learn about your own biases, say, by reading the Sheryl Sandberg book, and try your hardest to sort of work against those biases in the workplace.
And pitch me.
And pitch Dan Coyce. That's the next thing you should do. Pitch him, and if he says no, pitch him again.
Right. No, the fear of rejection thing, though, that I think, like, getting over that is the single best thing that I, like, have done in my career so far. I had, like, 6 months where I was freelancing and just had to be rejected. And I'm really, really glad that I did it.
I had a remarkable experience that taught me a lot with a young man, because I haven't been an editor or a manager for very long in my career. And he did not get a job that we had on offer. And within maybe 3 hours, he wrote me back and said, okay, but, you know, I think I've done this and that well, and I've been working here a long time, and I think it's, you know, time to find something else for me. So how about we go at it? Let's meet tomorrow. Like, I just can't imagine a woman doing that same thing. It was 3 hours. And you know what? It totally worked. We did exactly that. We found a place for him, and it all worked out well.
Good for him.
And
so
that's
it was
how
a
David
great
Plotz
lesson.
Became editor of Slate.
That's how David Plotz. And also, he was sleeping with me, so. Okay, well, that concludes our show. Me sleeping with David Plotz. Let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
So I finally watched what has been long touted to me as one of the great recent romantic comedies, which was Flirting with Disaster. It's a David O. Russell movie from the 90s, and it's kind of delightful. It's a like a caper movie, and it has a great cast. It has Ben Stiller and Taya Leone, and it's just a lot of fun for 90 minutes.
One of the things that I think about sometimes is how unhappy I would be if I went back in time and read my reviews of movies from the Daily Tar Heel. And that's a movie I reviewed for the Daily Tar Heel, and I know if I read it now, I would be so unhappy with how badly I portrayed how great that movie is.
Aww.
Because you portrayed it badly, or because you were overly eager about most movies?
No, because I just was not a particularly good writer, and I think, like, I remember David O. Russell's earlier movie, Spanking the Monkey, which I also reviewed. I remember I watched it and wrote about it after, like, several long sleepless nights of writing papers. And later, after it got published in the Daily Tar Heel, someone sent a letter in asking why I had used the word intense or tense 11 times in the review.
That's an awesome letter writer.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks
was
a
it,
lot.
Was it like your mom?
It was no, it was not. It was it, worse yet. It was just some girl from campus.
Okay, my recommendation. This book is a couple of years old. It's called Half a Life by Darren Strauss. I read it because I was thinking about memoirs, and particularly the subject of how you use sort of tragedy and bad things that happen to you well in a memoir. Maybe it's because of our Elizabeth Wurtzel discussion that I was thinking about that. And I remember somebody recommending this book, and it's so good. It's just about how he ran over, or a girl ran into him when he was in high school and she died, or he killed her, and how that haunted him for the rest of his life, sort of through his 20s and 30s. And it's really, really, really remarkable. I mean, just how that wormed its way into his life and how he lived with it for 20 and 30 years. And it's just an example of what to do with kind of salacious, tragic things that happen and how to turn them into a memoir. It's really, really great. Dan.
All right, so I'm going to recommend something for the kiddies who are listening, all you kids out there who are listening to the XX Gabfest, I recommend Luke Pearson's new graphic novel, Hilda and the Bird Parade. He draws these amazing comics set in this sort of vaguely Scandinavian magical world with trolls and elves and talking birds and stuff. But it also at the center of them is this just wisecracking preteen girl named Hilda, who is really in tune with the natural world and has a great relationship with her mom and likes to go out on adventures and meets interesting people and creatures and does interesting things. And they're gorgeous to look at, and they're great stories, and they're really smart and funny. And I think everyone should read and look at them.
That sounds fabulous. Well, thank you all for joining us today. Thank you to Chris Wade for engineering this podcast, to Andy Bowers, as always, the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. Please come on our XX Facebook page and tell us what you want us to talk about in the next couple of weeks. For Dan Coyce and Noreen Malone, I'm Hannah Rosen.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.